This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Our first stop is Wong's rural property in Penang's Back Hills. We need to see whether he's returned to his life of crime, as some say, or leading a reformed life. As we get closer, we go in by foot through the jungle.
In 2010, when law enforcement officers busted into this place, they found two Bengal tigers as well as a crocodile. The question now is that sort of thing still going on here?
There are people everywhere. One man comes within a few feet of us.
I'm not sure if he's patrolling or whether he's just another construction worker. But the fact that he's walking along the fence makes it a little bit worrisome that maybe he's guarding the place. I just don't know. And we can't chance it right now.
We turn back to try another route. An hour later, after hiking through the hills, we stumble on a number of cages. And then we spot an enclosure. There's a tortoise inside. Evidence that Wong is, at least, keeping animals. Further on, we find a row of newer enclosures. It's hard to make out what they are, so we creep closer. The animals have distinctive ears. We show our photos later to experts, who tell us these are serval cats from North Africa.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the show. It is Mira Sivasuthi. He is known as the Pablo Escobar of wildlife trafficking. Anson Wong is one of the world's most infamous wildlife traffickers who has twice been convicted for his activities. Despite this, he seems to have continued with his activities. Working with anti-trafficking groups, Al Jazeera's 101 East goes undercover to expose Anson Wong's Malaysia-based operation and the officials who allow it. Joining me, of course, is Steve Chow. Steve's actually the host for 101 East, Al Jazeera Asia's current affairs show, and Steve actually led the investigation to discuss this further. Welcome to the show, Steve. How are you today?
Very good. Thanks for having us on, Mira.
You know, what was your first exposure to Anson Wong?
Well, you know, when we first began looking into wildlife crime, we wanted to put a face to it because we knew the numbers were incredible. $26 billion is the estimate by the WWF in terms of how lucrative this illegal trade is today in the world. But we wanted to put a face to it. And when we talked to the wildlife groups that were protecting animals, they said to us, you know what, there already is a face to wildlife crime, and it's Anson Wong. Mm-hmm. And it was from that point that we decided, hey, you know what, let's look at him and see if, even though he's served collectively maybe 8 years in jail, let's see if he is still involved in the trafficking of wildlife.
Right.
And that's how we began.
Sure. How did it all start? And you led this investigation.
Yeah, correct. This was a year-long investigation. So it began sometime around this time last year. Mm-hmm. And we began sort of trying to infiltrate his syndicate and infiltrate the entire black market of wildlife trafficking. That involved traveling to Madagascar, one of the key source countries because of the biodiversity over there. It involved going to Thailand, Indonesia, and Malaysia, because these are often transit hubs where a lot of this wildlife smuggled from Africa or in Southeast Asia is stored before it's sent off to customers around the world.
Right. You actually went undercover, I understand. How did begin? And how did you get into, how did you infiltrate the network? I mean, that would have been quite difficult.
We thought it was going to be difficult. You know, we went in posing as dealers in a lot of these places. And incredibly, it would often take just a few hours or even just a day to make meetings with wildlife traffickers who were really right front and center in terms of being involved. Mm-hmm. And we'd being presented samples. For example, in Madagascar, the most endangered tortoise is the plowshare tortoise. Mm-hmm. The second most endangered is the radiated tortoise. These two are creatures that will likely be poached into extinction in the next 10, 20 years.
Right.
And within a day or so, we were sitting down in a hotel room with one of the traffickers. He had lots of socks full of these small tortoises. He'd pull them out and start promising us that he could ship hundreds to wherever we wanted in Asia. Mm-hmm. What shocked us, again, was the fact that it was very easy. They didn't need to look at our credentials. We just basically started talking to people in some markets, and they would lead us to these big-time dealers. The question we had in our head was, if it's so easy for us as journalists, what is law enforcement doing in all these countries?
Right, of course. And, I mean, did you... how did you capture all of this? Is it just audio? Did you manage to have hidden cameras to take all of this?
We had lots of hidden cameras, and I've been talking a bit about this in the last day or so.
Isn't that against the law, then? Isn't that against the law?
It depends on which country you're in. Okay. And we were always very careful that we were always following the law. And so, for hidden cameras in every country we were in, we were allowed to use them. We have strict rules at Al Jazeera as to when we do use them. It has to go to our head honcho, the director general of Al Jazeera, to approve.
Yeah.
And we had hidden cameras on our wrists, inside our shirts. A lot has changed. 20 years ago when we began using hidden cameras, there were these big, boxy, battery sort of type things that we'd have to hide in our pants. Today, they're very tiny, thanks to modern technology.
Yeah.
So we were able to get around using a number of small cameras and capture pretty well everything.
Right. So, just to digress a little, Steve, you've been a journalist for what, 20 years?
Correct.
20 years.
Coming on to two decades.
Yeah. What's that journey been like for you?
Well, it's incredible. I started journalism in Canada, and I slowly worked my way up from a local newsroom covering tornadoes and those sort of things to a national level, and led an investigative unit in Canada for a while. Often was doing investigations with the Russian mob. I had big bouncers pick me up, throw me out of boiler rooms, if you will. And then I went international, started covering a lot of international stories. I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan.
Yeah. So asking you the question of whether you were afraid for your life when you were uncovering this story of Anson Wong is probably irrelevant.
Well, definitely not irrelevant. You often wonder about your own safety. But I think, those, as you understand, those who've done it for a while, you understand that journalists have a responsibility. We're serving the role of being the fourth estate, keeping authorities and keeping the world very much accountable in terms of issues. And wildlife protection is a very important issue. And one thing I learned in all this is that the public perception of wildlife crime right now is still that it's a green crime. It's just about the environment. But what I learned in this year-long investigation is the fact that it is now tied very closely to some of the major crimes in the world. We're talking about the trade in narcotics, people trafficking, and we found that in many cases, major organized crime syndicates like the Triads in Hong Kong, the Yakuza in Japan, are using the proceeds of wildlife trafficking to fund other crimes. And that's how it all relates back to the individual person in various communities. If you the crime around us could be funded by the proceeds of wildlife trafficking, and that's ultimately why it's important to look at this.
Yeah, when you were investigating, did you uncover any of these links as to how this money was being channeled to other areas? Did you have that experience?
We had lots of cases where we saw this happening, where often, for example, a number of plowshare tortoises or radiated tortoises were being trafficked through certain countries, and sometimes they would be caught by customs officials. And in those instances, you'd often find cocaine or heroin mixed in with this group of tortoises, or mixed in with ivory or rhino horns, and it was proof positive that organized crime syndicates were getting involved because they're mixing everything together.
Mm-hmm. Which makes it even more difficult, isn't it?
Very much so.
Yeah.
And again, it goes back to the question of customs officials, wildlife officials. Many of the smugglers we talked to kept assuring us time and again that they had wildlife officials and customs officials in their pocket, including here in Malaysia.
Right. Okay. And you took this on to pursue this story for Al Jazeera. Is there a reason why you decided to pursue this story on Anson Wong? I mean, it could have been anything else, really.
It could have been anything else. Anson Wong, from what everyone was telling us, is an example, truly, of all that's gone wrong in the world's attempts to crack down on wildlife crime. It was 40 years ago to this year that more than 170 countries got together and said, hey, we're going to make a difference. We're going to save our iconic species in this world because it's important. And you talk to any of the experts, many of the top law enforcement officers like John Seller for the UN, he'll tell you, what? We've utterly failed.
There is no political will.
That's the question. Yeah. And, the fact that Anson Wong was convicted for 5 years and served only 17 months here in Malaysia for smuggling boa constrictors to Indonesia, raises the question. And the fact that what we didn't cover was that there were several other cases of crimes that he committed that authorities here were told about, but they never pursued, mm-hmm. raises more questions again about potential complicity by authorities here.
But he was convicted in the U.S., in Mexico, for an example.
That's
right. He was caught in Mexico, but that didn't deter him.
No.
From continuing what he was doing.
Which was quite amazing. And when we were in Penang and we were trying to track him down for the past year, he was driving around in a white pickup truck. The side of the truck had the name of one of his companies, Phuket Jumbo Reptile Sanctuary. Mm-hmm. He was operating out in the open. And yes, you know, we did do a paper trail. We found a number of shell companies he was involved in. But even then, that shell company was operating in a strip mall from the street. You could see all the pens of wildlife. So everything was done pretty well in the open.
Right. Did you meet him?
We did.
Okay. We'll come back and find that up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasudhi. Al Jazeera's 101 East has a documentary titled Return of the Lizard King. And of course, with me is host of 101 East and Al Jazeera Asia's current... It is Al Jazeera Asia's current affairs show. And we're discussing The Return of the Lizard King with Steve Chow. Now, Steve, you've got a very colourful resume as far as journalism is concerned. But, you know, did it take a lot of you to get involved and investigate the Anson Wong case?
It did. We had a big team involved. And, you know, 101 East's resources are quite, you know, tight. But we had a big team involved, a lot of producers, a lot of cameramen, mm-hmm. because it was a year-long investigation. We had to chase the paper trail. We had to maintain certain pages on Facebook to give us the illusion that we were undercover dealers. We spun it out as many ways as possible to try to lure wildlife traffickers into our net, if you will.
Were you successful?
We were. Mm-hmm. In one case in Indonesia, for example, we met up with a person that had dealt with Anson Wong for more than 30 years.
Wow.
And he told us right away that Anson Wong's children called him uncle.
Right.
And shortly after sitting down with him, he began to reveal that the 2010 conviction that Anson Wong had been convicted for, the smuggling of 95 boa constrictors and other animals to Indonesia, was actually destined for his shop.
Right.
And to this day, that gentleman has never been brought up on charges of being complicit with Anson Wong.
Right. So you did mention that you met Anson Wong. How did that meeting occur? And how did he let you walk into this trap?
Well, you know, I can't reveal too much because I want viewers to actually watch our documentary, which airs 6:30 tomorrow morning on Friday.
Okay.
But... what I can say is that it did take a long time to track him down. We had heard rumors in Madagascar that he was around there. We had heard rumors at times that he was in Thailand, in Indonesia. And then we amazingly tracked him down in Penang. And it involved lots of hours of stakeouts and understanding his movements, checking out a lot of the properties where he had companies mm-hmm. and were running a big, thriving wildlife trade.
Okay.
From.
Did you travel a lot for the investigation, besides, of course, Indonesia?
Yeah, we did. You know, we were in Thailand. We were following wildlife officials there as they sort of got trained up to recognize what is truly a species that's endangered and what's just a normal species. We were at the airports in Thailand and elsewhere as well, trying to monitor how things are trafficked. Most of our time was spent in a lot of the source countries like Madagascar, for example. Madagascar is a key source country for Anson Wong mm-hmm. because he loves the plowshare tortoise that we talked about, this rare endangered tortoise that can sell for as much as $25,000.
What's so special about it?
It's simply the fact that there are now only 400 adults left in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And the shell of it is, they're quite unique. If you look online for the plowshare tortoise, you'll notice the shells are very unique and they're considered the crown in the jewel of the reptile trade
right.
because of that.
Right. And let me guess, it's an aphrodisiac as well?
No, actually. Amazingly they're usually collected as pets. And that's one thing that we've seen quite a bit around the world as well, especially in Asia and in the Middle East. It's now in vogue for people with money to spend a lot of dollars having these exotic pets around their properties. This
right.
is something we saw, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, often in North America, in the U.S. or Europe. Now it's in vogue among the nouveau riche, if you will, in Asia and in the Middle East to have all these pets.
Right. I remember doing a show on ivory poaching, trafficking as well.
Yep.
And a lot of it was going through Malaysia towards China. China, of course, is a huge market for a lot of this. But at the same time, China has very strict laws as far as, you know, trafficking is concerned. Do you think they're doing enough?
Well, it comes
across as being very strong, you know. They're cracking down quite strongly on wildlife traffickers.
Yeah, is China doing enough? We've had lots of conversations with wildlife traffickers who are still managing to get a lot of the wildlife into China. Mm-hmm. So are they doing enough? We know very clearly that a lot of the wildlife authorities there are also on the take. Mm-hmm. So I think that it is a country that still needs a lot of work in terms of showing an earnestness in wanting to crack down on the trade.
Right. But there's often this issue of when the buying stops, then there will be no need for trafficking. I mean, a lot of this responsibility rests on us, Steve. Is there a way of getting people involved in this or more involved in this? Because I mean, just a random check of, you know, people around me as to who Anson Wong is, and you'll be surprised how so many people in this country don't know who Anson Wong is, which tells you our priorities and what sort of exposure we have.
Very much so.
We
talked to the Environment Minister, G. Palanivelu, about Anson Wong, mm-hmm. and we had an interview with him. And his first response was what you said. Despite the fact that he's from Penang, he himself had never heard of the Lizard King.
Right. But to be fair, he was only in office 2 months when he took over.
Very true, but he's from the hometown in Penang.
Did you speak to the former Environment Minister?
Unfortunately, we didn't. This is the person that the Wildlife Department sort of pushed our interview towards. So he was the one we pushed a lot of the questions at. Now, what should the public do? It's a very good point that you make. The analogy I often like to bring up is the fact that 20 to 30 years ago, drinking and driving was acceptable in a lot of places.
Yeah.
It was still somewhat negative, but you know what? People did it. It's all right. But now, today, it's almost a social taboo. And that's sort of the place that I think that wildlife crime needs to get to. A lot of people today, I think, still are okay if their neighbors have an exotic pet or if their neighbors are drinking some kind of medicine made from endangered animal parts. But until it gets to the point where it's a social taboo, nothing's going to change. The reality is that the public needs to stand up, and it goes back to the corruption issue again. The people need to let governments know that corruption is not acceptable, that wildlife officials working for the government paid by public tax dollars should not be enriching themselves, that customs officials should not be enriching themselves. We talked to one person that we call X in our documentary. Mm-hmm. He is one of the key members of a big syndicate. And we asked him, how do you stop all this? And he said, it's very simple. It can be stopped in one day if officials are stopped from being on the take. Mm-hmm. We can't then, therefore, get goods from point A to point B. And then he laughs because it'll never happen, he said.
Right.
And until the public makes the governments accountable, things will not happen.
How do you verify some of these things that people have said?
And that's a very good question. Mm-hmm. You know, it comes from multiple interviews. We're dealing with a lot of shady characters working in the shady underworld of wildlife trafficking. Mm-hmm. So we had to ask a lot of these questions to many of them and get some corroboration. We also worked hand in hand with a lot of the wildlife protection groups. They are also gathering a great deal of information. And so a lot of it is old school journalism, you know, checking the information that we're getting, making sure it is corroborated, double checking, triple checking, and making sure we have it right.
Right. D. Moby is asking via text message, would you have uncovered Anson Wong's financial backers?
That's a very good question.
Did you? Were you able to?
The hardest part here in Malaysia is being able to search public records. Things are not as transparent as it is in the U.S. or in Canada, where I've done a lot of work over the years. So getting financial records, those sort of things are very difficult. We would have loved to have found more about Anson Wong's financial supporters. Mm-hmm. We got only so far as to look at some of the profits that he was making or listing as having made with these companies. Mm-hmm. And that's as deep as we got with him. But that's a very good question. The government here has a lot of information on him. We know we've talked to a mule, for example, someone from Madagascar who carried the tortoises over for Anson Wong to Malaysia. She was caught and served 8 months in jail here. She squealed. She told the authorities everything mm-hmm. in terms of Anson Wong's dealings. But to this day, Anson Wong has never been brought up on charges in that incident. And there are questions as to what authorities do know about him and why they're not acting.
Right. How did you put the documentary together, Steve? I mean, there must have been so much material that you had. You know, how did you formulate the story? How did it come to be?
Yeah, it's very difficult.
Yeah,
you're right. You know,
like, where do you start? Where do you end?
They always say that, you know, as you're editing and as we're editing, you're killing your darlings,
exactly.
If you will. You know, we had so much tape from all the hidden cameras, so
imagine.
Many great interviews. And unfortunately, we had to condense it down to a half hour show.
Yeah.
We probably had enough for an hour show. But, you know, to make it really impacting, our editor said, OK, let's keep it at a half hour and let the public discuss this issue, you know, broadly and loudly.
Yeah.
But it was painful.
I'm sure. I mean, did you at any point go in and say, you know, no, I think this should go in, you know?
Oh, yeah, we
editor,
had lots of heated
always,
discussions with the editors, right?
Is he still your best friend?
Very much so. Luckily, you know, we're very congenial and everyone sort of works together in a team, but there were definitely heated conversations. There was one case where a lawyer was saying, you can't put this in. You cannot put this in. I can't tell you what that part was.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, but it's the best part in the documentary. In the end, you know, we had to listen to our legal advice, and there were definitely different heads, you know, thinking different things about it. But, you know, that's part of the whole creative process.
What's the process like? I mean, when you're done, right, do you have to send it in for approval?
We do, especially in terms of investigations like this. We need to make sure, once again, that everything we have in terms of evidence is solid and that we're not slandering or defaming anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that often means going through a number of checks, going through our senior editors and going through our legal counsel, not only here, but also in London internationally. And they vet and inspect everything with a fine-tooth comb. So it's a slow and arduous process, but we believe it keeps us accurate. And that ultimately is important because we're serving the public. We're serving the public good. And in this case, you know, we're focusing on one person, Anson Wong.
You know, Steve, it's going to air tomorrow morning, I understand, 6:30, am
correct.
I correct?
Yes.
Are you not concerned that Malaysia might just pull the rug from right underneath you, you know, and say, I'm sorry, you're not going to air this? Are you not concerned at all?
Well, you know, it's happened in the past with a few of our stories that we've broadcast on 101 East.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the same time, you know, our
in
news
Malaysia.
Channel in Malaysia during mm-hmm. the Bursi rallies, of course, you know, we were taken off the air, off Astro. And we've voiced our concerns as a result. And we hope that the government has heard those concerns and will listen and allow the public free access to information. Because ultimately, that's what it's about. Free access to information, allowing the public to decide what to believe and what not to believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, controlling that kind of information is not healthy for any society. And so we've always stressed that. This is why we have our base in Asia here in Kuala Lumpur, a belief that the Malaysian government will live up to its promises that it made us several years ago when we moved down here for Al Jazeera, to have that freedom of access for all Malaysians in this country.
What are you hoping the viewers will take away from this broadcast?
We're hoping that it will generate a lively discussion, that people will ask the hard questions to the government as to what's happening here. Anson Wong is a convicted criminal. He has served collectively 8 years in jail, and yet he's operating with customs permits, operating with business licenses that Perhelatan, the Wildlife Department, 3 years ago in 2010, said very clearly that they had rescinded, that they had taken away.
Mm-hmm.
But here he is operating, and our questions to him were very much, his responses to the questions we had for him were very much geared towards this. You know, what is the Malaysian government doing? Is the question ultimately that we think we leave with the public at the end of this.
You spoke to Perhelatan as well?
We tried to speak to Perhelatan. And they pushed us again to the environment minister.
Right. Very clever, isn't it? How optimistic are you that your investigation or this, you know, documentary will actually change the world, Steve? I mean, do you just chug along and do as much as you can and hope for the best?
I think that's ultimately the hope of every journalist,
yeah,
that whatever we do, whatever we put out there, that it will bring some social change. I think sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. The fact that the world has been fighting for 40 years to try to rein in wildlife trafficking makes it a sort of disheartening prospect in terms of the future.
Yep.
But I think that, once again, if all of us do our part, and that's what all we're doing, a small part in trying to generate public discussion, to raise awareness. If we all do that, then something can change. Mm-hmm.
And if we sort of, you know, address Anson Wong and some of the other kingpins in the world, and I understand there are only a few of them, Steve, am I correct?
Correct.
Just a handful of them. Controlling $26 billion, did you say?
Correct.
$26 billion trade.
It's incredible, isn't it?
In the hands of about a few people.
A few people. You know, interesting enough, of all the countries that seem to be leading the way in terms of cracking down, the U.S. last week, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced a $1 million bounty for information leading to the dismantling of a wildlife syndicate based in Laos. This is a foreign country, the U.S., offering a bounty for somebody in a different country. Mm-hmm. And that's very forward-thinking. And the interesting part here, though, as well, is it comes back to Malaysia, because Kerry also listed Malaysia as one of the key source countries used by this Laotian to hold wildlife. Mm-hmm. And this, once again, is a key problem, that the wildlife being housed here is not necessarily the wildlife that you find living in Malaysia, but people are bringing wildlife here and keeping it here. Why? Wildlife traffickers have told us it's because there is no fear of authorities here, that they know they can get away with it. So they house it here, far away from the hands of authorities who can get it, and then they traffic it out to customers.
Are you saying if we kill the kingpins, we will get rid of the trade?
I think it makes a difference. I think that if there is a message that can be had from the arrest of a wildlife trafficker, a kingpin, is that they have to do their business differently. We've already seen the impact. Thailand, for example, hosted this year's CITES conference. This is the conference
of all endangered countries.
Species, yeah. Correct. Mm-hmm. And the authorities this year, knowing that they were hosting this conference, agreed to get much harder on wildlife crime. And at the airport in Bangkok, we've heard from wildlife traffickers that the amount of seizures has now made them route their goods through other countries. Mm-hmm. So there is an impact when you come down hard.
Right. We have a listener who's saying, well, don't worry if you're not allowed to broadcast the documentary. Put it on the internet, and I promise I'll share it.
You know, that's a very good comment. Fantastic. Thank you for promising to share it. We do put it online after our broadcast. So, you know, if you tune in Friday or Saturday, okay, you know, onto whether it's our Facebook site, you know, www.facebook.com/101East, or check out our Al Jazeera website, you'll see the story.
Fantastic. Al Jazeera's 101 East, Return of the Lizard King, premieres here in Malaysia tomorrow morning, 6:30 a.m., with subsequent broadcasts at 6:30 p.m., and then again on Saturday, the 23rd, at 12:30 p.m., and on Monday, the 25th, at 1:30 a.m. You can join the conversation on Twitter as well, using hashtag AJWildlife, and join in that conversation. What would you like to leave us with, Steve, before you leave?
Just a big message out there that wildlife crime is not a green crime. It's not just about protecting the environment, protecting certain species. It's about the fact that today it's such a lucrative business that organized crime syndicates are getting involved, and that affects us all.
It was a pleasure having you on. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Steve Chow, host for 101 East, which is Al Jazeera Asia's current affairs show, on the documentary titled Return of the Lizard King, on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.